Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is the Long War Journal with Bill Raggio. Bill and his colleague Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. The chronology, the explanation, the illustration of the vast canvas of the Ummah in the contest with the jihadists. Right now we're concentrating on one part of that map. This is Afghanistan. Why is in the news? The U.S. has made a decision. NATO has gone along with that decision to pull back and turn the Afghan defenses over to the National Army, the police, and the government in Kabul. We begin, however, as we do all the time now, with an important illustration of the problem. I call it the map. Bill Raggio keeps a map of Afghanistan, divided up into the provinces, divided up into the districts. And that map tells you that the Taliban is aggressive. Aggressive to the point that this story in the Times of London makes sense. It is a tragedy, but there it is, what's going on. A popular comedian was among several people summarily killed by Taliban forces in Afghanistan, where tens of thousands of refugees are fleeing the advancing insurgents, with fighting raging on the outskirts of Kandahar, the second city in the country. Nazar Muhammad, an entertainer, was dragged from his home and killed. Militants were said to be going house to house, searching for government workers in the province. Photographs showed the comedian, who had previously served in the local police, backed up against a tree and then lying on the ground with his throat cut. The Taliban denied involvement in the murder, but Muhammad's family accused the insurgents. Bill, a very good evening to you. Kandahar. There is fighting at the outskirts of Kandahar, the second largest city. Your map has Kandahar in government control. We spoke a week ago about the map, and at that point, Kandahar was not seen as risk. Contested, but not at risk. What has changed in the south? What has changed on the map? Good day to you, Bill.
Hello, John. Yeah, and certainly not a good evening in Afghanistan. Haven't been many of those in quite some time. So Kandahar City, it's a city as well as a district. So Afghanistan has 407 of these districts. Think of them as counties here in the United States. It's currently contested. It has been contested for some time. The Taliban have been launching attacks in there and control some outlying areas of the city, which they use to launch attacks. Over the last 2 weeks, particularly, the Taliban have been launching significant attacks inside of the city and into neighborhoods almost to the heart of the city. They've approached the large jail there. A curfew had to be imposed on the city in order to try and limit the movement at night. You're seeing police and military forces attacked. The fighting is particularly tense at time and brutal. The U.S. military has launched airstrikes in support of Afghan military and police forces inside of Kandahar City, which increases the risk of civilian casualties from the U.S. side. The Taliban is able to do what it's doing in Kandahar, and not just Kandahar City, but there's 17 other cities that are under direct threat of the Taliban right now, where the Taliban are either inside neighborhoods within the city or launching attacks on the city from the outside. So Kandahar isn't unique, although it is one of the most important cities inside the country. It was the home of the Taliban. It's really where the Taliban ruled when they controlled Afghanistan, or most of it, 90% of it, up till September 10th, 2001. This latest offensive and with Kandahar City is – facilitated by the Taliban's takeover of four strategic districts surrounding the city. This began in late May and up and through June and July. They took control of the Zari and Argandab and Dand and Shawali Kot. It controls the reaches to Kandahar City. There's only one district called Daman and it's contested along with the city. And that's to the sort of the southeast and east of Kandahar City. And that's their Taliban are fighting to try to gain control of that. And once that happens, they'll have the city under a stranglehold. As I noted, attacks are occurring in the city and they're all occurring from the north, the west and the south because the Taliban control those districts. This is how the Taliban has used its rural insurgency strategy to creep closer and closer to the cities and to ultimately strangle them. And then also the Taliban is launching, starting to execute government workers and civilians. It's select, but it is happening. It's happening in and around Kandahar City, and it's happening in Spin Baldock, which is a district along the border with a crucial border crossing to where more than $1 billion the Afghan government used to get. The Taliban now control that border crossing to Pakistan, and there's reports that they executed, I've seen anywhere from 150 to over 300 members of a police unit that was vehemently opposed to the Taliban. That unit has been defeated and they fled back to Kandahar City, where they're now putting up opposition, sort of a last stand to the Taliban.
Bill, I'm looking at the map that you've built very carefully for us about Taliban operations in and around Kandahar City. It would appear that the Taliban have cut the main road from Kabul. Is that correct, or is that road being fought over?
The roads are really difficult to assess. At the very least, so there's districts that are under Taliban control, between Kandahar and Kabul. That's the ring road or route one. It's the main highway in Afghanistan. But the Afghan government, occasionally they'll be able to run convoys to and from. So holding a road is a lot more difficult. They can run convoys. They'll come under attack. But so the fact that eastern approach to Kandahar City is still open, if that was Taliban controlled, they could really put the squeeze on the city. So yeah, we're actually, John, you're getting a little ahead of me here, but we're working on a map to try and assess the status of the roads throughout Afghanistan. It's very complicated. What the Taliban often does on the roads is put up checkpoints and blocking points at times, but it's fluid. Sometimes they'll pull them to use operations elsewhere. But this is how they were able to take control of Spin Baldock. They just marched down that road, laid roadblocks, and took control of the road so the Afghan military couldn't reinforce the Spin Baldock. And again, that's a crucial district. At times these roads will open and military convoys, if they roll in big enough, they'll be able to get through. But the Afghan government doesn't control these roads.
It appears that the airstrikes are aimed at southern Kandahar. The general in charge of the U.S. forces explained that the airstrikes are meant to supplement the Afghan National Army and the Afghan police. At the same time, the Pentagon has announced that the airstrikes in some fashion will end, and that the U.S. will no longer send in operational spotters. I mean, to have these kind of airstrikes, it means that we have a U.S. personnel on the ground. That's the way that's the protocol. I can't say that that's a fact. That's the protocol. So is your understanding, Bill, that the policy of airstrike is evolving, that they'll change it according to circumstances and continue?
Yeah, the U.S. military, on the direction of the Biden administration, was going to cut off airstrikes as the withdrawal was going on. But that is changing because the administration and the U.S. military, which really downplayed the Taliban's offensive at the very beginning of this, when I'm estimating over 100 districts at a certain point in time were overrun, the military was saying like 20 districts were overrun. Now they've caught up to our numbers. There were only about a dozen apart. It's probably because they're behind again, but these airstrikes are happening because they're recognizing that as there's still a U.S. presence in Afghanistan, that cities may actually fall. The airstrikes have primarily focused on Kandahar as well as in Helmand as well. They claim that they're targeting hardware like artillery pieces that the U.S. handed over to the Afghan military, Humvees, armored vehicles, things of that nature. there's a lot of confusion over the issue of airstrikes and what over the horizon means and what they're actually going to target. What the military and the administration had said was that these would only be used in a counterterrorism capacity. That means striking at Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, groups like that, but not necessarily the Taliban, which they wrongly viewed as something disconnected from all this. In the case of the Islamic State, that's true. The Taliban and Islamic State are enemies. That makes Al-Qaeda the enemy of the Islamic State as well. But with Al-Qaeda, how do you discern between the two groups? The Taliban is sheltering, supporting, and Al-Qaeda is fighting alongside the Taliban in Helmand and Kandahar. And I've heard reports, I've had information that some of these strikes have been targeting Al-Qaeda, in particularly in Helmand, where the Al-Qaeda has a significant presence, but also in Kandahar. So I think this has been used to, I don't want to say trick, but to muddle the issue and has allowed the U.S. to engage the Taliban. Because, you know, when they talk counterterrorism, a lot of, you know, the casual watcher doesn't know that that is supposed to mean Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. But to me, it's a direct recognition that this withdrawal was not responsible as the U.S. military has labeled it. It's been completely irresponsible because they didn't factor in the Taliban's offensive, which, by the way, is a complete intelligence failure from the Afghan military, Afghan intelligence, and U.S. military, U.S. intelligence. Same goes for NATO. No one saw this coming. I think, John, as you and your listeners know, we did. We've talked about this. We saw this coming, and we were warning about this. It's the entire reason I created this map in 2014.
Your map saw it coming for years. Bill, yeah. Years. I mean, it wasn't hard to see the logic of what the Taliban was doing.
It's the reason I created this map, was to serve as a warning to show people, hey, this isn't working. What we're doing, this population-centric counterinsurgency, isn't working. The Afghan government can't stand up to this. And the Taliban waited for the U.S. to announce its withdrawal and waited till that May 1st deadline so it could look like it was legitimately following the Doha deal, which we all know is a farce, and pulled the trigger and launched its offensive. You know, John, I actually powered down my work a little bit in the winter because I knew that when this happened, there would be a crush. I've been working ridiculous amount of, you know, 14, 16, 18 hour days trying to figure out what's going on here and track this. I knew I needed to take a little break in the spring and write a little bit less. And, you know, it doesn't mean I wasn't watching and reading, but that's how much I knew this was coming. And the fact that General Miller is out there saying, well, we have to figure out how and why this happened. Well, I could have told you that in the winter, or I could have told you this 2 years ago. I could have told you this 4 years ago, how and why. I'm not the top general in Afghanistan. I'm some guy working in New Jersey that just follows this closely. This is a complete failure on a political level, an intelligence level, a military level, a failure in leadership. And in one day, I hope Tom and I are able to write the book about this, because it is disgraceful what's happened. And we need to tell this story.
Bill Raja, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. When we come back, the capitals of Eurasia are witnessing this collapse of the Afghan army to defend itself. What are they doing about it? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. This is a chronology, a map, an explanation for what we're witnessing across the vast landscape of the Ummah in the contest with the jihadists. At the same time, we're focusing on the battlefield of Afghanistan, the end of the U.S. and NATO commitment to military affairs, caveat, in Afghanistan. However, we have to cite what is apparent is that the collapse is leading to, one, casualties among the civilians. The U.N. is reporting. Civilian casualties in Afghanistan reached record levels in the first half of 2021. The United Nations warned, noting that deaths and injuries spiked markedly from May when the United States and its allies began withdrawing troops. Some 5,183 casualties were recorded in the first 6 months of the year. The number of deaths and injuries recorded during May and June alone was 2,392, almost as high as the total for the preceding 4 months. Bill, I turn to the refugee catastrophe. It's underway in Syria. It's underway in Iraq. It's certainly underway in Venezuela. It's about to be recognized as underway in Afghanistan. We talked about the refugees on the road when the Taliban entered outskirts of Kandahar and murdered that comedian because he'd been a member of the police force. Those refugees are going to move into other countries in the area and then transfer as far out of Afghanistan as possible because of the threat of throat cutting. I start with India. This is a report from the Foreign Policy magazine. India, traditionally reluctant to engage with the Taliban, recently hedged its bets by initiating contact with Qatar's support. You will remember Qatar has hosted the so-called peace talks between the Taliban and, well, not the Kabul government, but representatives of the United States and other interested countries. This report goes on to say, but unlike many in the West, India's leadership is not buying into the narrative of Kabul's impending fall and the Taliban's immediate and inevitable return to power. Instead, New Delhi insists how the Taliban gain power in Afghanistan is important. India has made it clear it will not accept the Taliban's violent overthrow of the Kabul government and has engaged in a flurry of diplomacy to prepare for the region's post-U.S. order. Well, it's here. What is your measure, Bill, about dealing with the Taliban in this, what you'd have to say, partly cloudy fashion? You know, we're not sympathetic to the Taliban taking over the whole country, but we'll exchange thoughts and maybe even cash if they just stay to the rural area. Is that a practical solution, Bill?
No, it's not a practical solution because the Taliban won't, as we can see with these offensives on the capitals, provincial capitals, and its statements such as one 7 days after the Doha agreement where the Taliban issued a religious statement or a fatwa saying the only acceptable outcome was the reestablishment of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. That's the name of the Taliban's government pre-9/11 and what the Taliban calls itself today, with its Emir Mullah Habibullah Akhundzada as the overall leader of this Islamic Emirate, which he is right now. And the serious people that I speak to in India recognize that the Taliban are these are people within the military intelligence establishment, recognize that the Taliban is a group that they're not going to be able to deal with, that it's a group that can't be trusted. I don't know what this reach out, what these contacts, you know, what this is all about. It could just be getting feelers and trying to understand the group's organization and who its leaders are in Doha, but that isn't the real political leadership in Afghanistan. The real political leaders are like Siraj Akhani, who's not in Doha, who is one of the two Taliban deputy mayors who's been responsible for this offensive. Like I said, the Indians know about this. They understand this. I suspect there's other reasons for this outreach for the Taliban, if it's indeed true. The Indians understand what the Taliban is. You got to remember, I believe it was it in 1998 where the Taliban, a Pakistani terror group hijacked an Indian airliner and landed it in Kandahar, and the Taliban, you know, welcomed it and they negotiated the release of jihadists. The Indians are quite familiar. They understand that the Taliban is in league with Al-Qaeda and Jaish Muhammad and Lashkar-e-Taiba, all jihadist groups supported by the Pakistani government, and that the Taliban is ultimately their enemy. So I suspect the Indians reaching out in fashion like this, there's other reasons for this.
Bill Rajo, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, another capital involved is Moscow. We're headed there next. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Looking at the map of Afghanistan, the neighboring countries are watching as the U.S. and NATO leave the country in terms of military commitment. And the Afghan National Army is fending off, for now, the Taliban offensive against the large provincial capitals such as Kandahar. However, there is the expectation that this can go very badly. So I go to an independent report from Afghanistan about how Moscow views the collapse of the Afghan National Army and the Kabul government's threatened Kabul government. This is Dateline Kabul. Moscow and Dushanbe, that's the capital of Tajikistan to the north, have conferred on joint measures to ward off threats from the Taliban to Tajikistan. TASS news agency reported that Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and his Tajik counterpart, Shirali Mirzo, discussed the situation in Afghan-Tajik border areas on Saturday. Minister Sergei Shoigu, promised that his country, Russia, would help Tajikistan build a new outpost on the border. The allies will hold military drills in August, forthcoming, the next weeks. Last I saw, there were reports of more than 6,000 Russian military personnel in Tajikistan. The foreign minister in Moscow was quoted as saying this: the parties discussed joint measures to neutralize threats related to the escalating situation in Afghanistan. Bill, we can't see into Moscow, but we know that they have a bad history with Afghanistan. They fought a war there for 10 years and left in despair. There are plenty of men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s in Moscow, missing limbs or with dark thoughts about their time in Afghanistan. How do you measure the Taliban? Is it in position to spread its poison into Central Asia, into the stands? Is Moscow well served to build a new outpost on the border?
Yeah, the Russians, you know, they certainly have a complicated relationship with the Taliban and obviously with Afghanistan with its occupation there from up until 1989. The Russians supported the Taliban in a minor way, far, far less than that of Pakistan or to another degree, much less than the Iranians. But they've armed some Taliban groups along the border in the effort of spreading its influence. But now that the Taliban is taking control of much of the borders of Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan specifically are directly threatened. These are all sort of Russian vassal states, if you will. They're concerned about what the Taliban is going to do. Now, the Taliban itself has a vested interest in not launching attacks and allowing its violence to spread across these borders. But the groups that are in the Taliban alliance or whatever you want to describe it, I think alliance is probably just fine. Turkestan Islamic Party, Islamic Movement, Uzbekistan. I could go on and on with the name of Central Asian jihadist groups that currently fight alongside the Taliban in northern and Afghanistan and throughout the country. These groups are definitely eyeing across the border, and these are the ones you can't rely on the Taliban to keep its word to stop these groups from going across the border. And that's what Russia's concerned about. That's what Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, that's what they're all concerned about. All of their moves are purely defensive. You don't expect Tajikistan or Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan to launch airstrikes across the border or have incursions. It's going to be defensive. It's going to be locked down the borders. It's going to be more repression against dissidents and whatnot inside the country, you know, more surveillance of mosques and known agitators and, you know, going just against political dissidents, because that's what these countries do. They tend to not to use these types of crises to take control of any also legitimate domestic political opposition as well.
Al-Qaeda, ISIS. In a lengthy essay at Foreign Affairs magazine by the distinguished commentator Seth Jones, who's written about the war in Eurasia for many years, he identifies some of the problems that we can see now in these tormented remarks by Moscow, by Delhi, by Kabul, even by the Taliban spokesman saying, yeah, well, we'll share power as long as you remove Ghani and we can choose our own government. So these are tormented remarks. We can't be certain of their fate, but we can speculate about what Afghanistan will look like. And Al-Qaeda is part of that mix. Bill, we're not going to debate whether Al-Qaeda is president or not, because your page has long since made the very clear case this and this and this. Al-Qaeda has never been far from the Taliban. They work closely together. The Haqqani network is the connection. What do we know now about Al-Qaeda's thinking about post-U.S., post-NATO? Do we have any sense? Have they given away their hand?
Al-Qaeda's been very quiet about this. Anything about Afghanistan that's come from Al-Qaeda has come from the affiliates. So Shabab has mentioned the Taliban victory in Afghanistan and how it's a boon for jihadists worldwide. Same thing with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. But Al-Qaeda Central itself has been mum on this, and it's done so because it wants the Taliban to win. And if the Al-Qaeda comes out and advertises its presence inside of Afghanistan, then it gives the West reason to stay. So they played a very clever political game here in Afghanistan. It's definitely smart for them to keep quiet, but it doesn't mean they're not fighting in the ranks of the Taliban. And as a matter of fact, and this is just in the UN report, I noted this several months ago, which actually made it in the previous UN report, that Al-Qaeda, it has a magazine called Thabat, and it's actually advertising fighting alongside the Afghan Taliban. Previously, I think I counted it in 18 provinces within Afghanistan where Thabat was actually, and there's 34 provinces total, so more than half. This time around, when UN did the counting, it showed that Al-Qaeda was advertising its fighting in Afghanistan in 15. Now, what Westerners like to do is say, well, that's Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. That's its subgroup. It's not the Al-Qaeda we need to worry about. But as you know, as you and your listeners know, after listening to Tom and I for years, that's not how all this work. These branches, these affiliates, however you want to describe them, they're all part of the Al-Qaeda network. They swap fighters and they take orders from on high, and they are executing Al-Qaeda's goal of reestablishing a global caliphate. That's what they want. That's what they're all fighting for, to discern between Al-Qaeda Central and Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, which is Al-Qaeda's obviously branch in the Indian subcontinent. It's a mistake, but what this does is show how close the Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship is and how much Al-Qaeda is supporting the Taliban's military operations.
All right,
Seth, a previous report from the – oh, go ahead.
Now, Seth Jones offers three options. You'll be able to finish your sentence with these three options. The first is drop everything. Just leave. That's the first option. That, of course, would have implications for Al-Qaeda. The second option is to provide money and equipment to these security forces, but to outsource military operations. And he suggests India or Pakistan. The third is what he says is called armed overwatch, providing air and covert forces. That looks to be the most attractive right now, according to Seth Jones. However, you're taking those three options. Does Al-Qaeda get ruled out at any of those options? One, drop everything. That sounds like it would bless Al-Qaeda. Two,
absolutely,
money and equipment and offload to India and Pakistan, if that's possible. What does that do up for Al-Qaeda? And three, armed overwatch. What does that do for Al-Qaeda? Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, the first option we don't even need to discuss. That's an Al-Qaeda victory with the Taliban. The second option, I mean, I can't believe Seth Jones would say, trust Pakistan to do this. I mean, let's just take the fox, put it in the hen house, and keep feeding it hens. Pakistan is the reason why this all happens. It's the prime supporter of the Taliban. Pakistan has no love for Al-Qaeda, but it has overlooked the Taliban's role in supporting and nurturing and keeping Al-Qaeda alive in Afghanistan and thriving. India can't do what we're expecting India to do, what we couldn't do. India doesn't have the resources to do this, and it will just inflame Pakistan's support anyway. The last option, this sort of armed overwatch, my understanding in reading his piece, he's talking about using it to strike at Al-Qaeda. But the problem in all of this, and this is what everyone seems to miss in Washington, our policymakers, when you ignore the close Taliban-Al-Qaeda ties, the fact that two are joined at the hip, and this was the point I was going to make before you began discussing Seth's point, Sirajuddin Haqqani, one of two deputy emirs of the Taliban and its most influential and powerful leader, the man responsible for this designing and executing this offensive, he was identified in the last UN report as a leader within Al-Qaeda. What does that make the Taliban? If Siraj Haqqani is both the Taliban's deputy emir and a leader within Al-Qaeda, an influential leader within Al-Qaeda, How is just striking at Al-Qaeda going to make a difference if we're going to ignore the Taliban takeover? So this is the dilemma that, you know, a lot of people, I think the good idea fairy starts coming out for a lot of people and when they're making policy recommendations, but they really don't understand the realities on the ground in Afghanistan. They don't understand the intense, deep, and enduring ties between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and how we can expect a lesser version of what we tried to work when the greater version of that failed.
I'm speaking to Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And he keeps the Long War Journal with his colleague Tom Jocelyn and their colleagues. We're discussing where we are right now in Afghanistan. Kandahar is besieged by the Taliban. This is a small version of the larger story of what is to be done. The U.S. is sending in airstrikes that may or may not have relieved some aspects of the siege. As I understand it, the airport is still under attack. The roads are not clearly open to Kandahar. Neighborhoods are being attacked. We've already given an illustration of one popular comedian being butchered, massacred, murdered in front of his neighbors because he at one time served in the Afghan police force. So what we're looking at here is a small scale of what we can expect when and if the Taliban takes over Kabul and other large cities. When we come back, we're going to explore Seth Jones's recommendations in detail, the military detail of what will work. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio is here of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And we've looked at the Afghan map, which is not going, Afghanistan map, which is not going in the direction of success for the Kabul government. Kandahar is under siege. We've considered the neighborhood, Delhi preparing for worst possible, Moscow preparing for worst possible. We could touch the other capitals, Islamabad, Tehran, Beijing. No one's preparing for success after this. The U.S., what's it preparing? Seth Jones has recommendations. The first is to keep up the flow of cash and equipment into Afghanistan going forward. This under the umbrella of armed overwatch. The first option is to feed the war machine. The United States should provide at least $3 billion a year in aid to Afghan security forces to fight the Taliban. The rough amount it is paying today and what will be needed in the future to sustain the infrastructure. Bill, is money going to do it for the Afghan National Army?
No, it's not, John. I mean, we've thrown money at this problem year after year after year. Things like training take time. How is this going to happen? You know, the question that has to be asked, one of the questions that has to be asked, how bad is the U.S. military at training foreign militaries? Didn't work so well in Iraq. We saw the Islamic State rampage. Not working real well in Somalia. And obviously is working very poorly in Afghanistan. So how are we going to do this remotely? How is just throwing money at training, which takes years and years to show results, when the Afghans are in a fight for their lives right now? I don't understand how throwing money at this problem is going to fix it. This is what people in D.C. like, throwing money at problems. So I suspect that this is this proposal.
Yes, and $3 billion is a rounding error. So we go to a second recommendation by Seth Jones, part of armed overwatch, which is to fly regular missions, striking targets and gathering intelligence, and basing out of perhaps Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and getting the cooperation of Russians who are worried about this, also basing aircraft out of the Indian Ocean. Are airstrikes going to be capable of stemming the advance as we see in Kandahar?
Airstrikes, before I get to the issue of basing, airstrikes alone we were doing these prior to the U.S. leaving. All it did was keep the Taliban from taking control of major cities. Now what the Taliban has done, before they were in, like, say, the second level from the cities. They were two districts over. Now they're right next door to the cities. They've surrounded multiple major cities. Airstrikes alone will not dislodge the Taliban. You need infantry. You need ground forces to do this. And, you know, can the Afghan military do this? Their commandos and special forces are pretty good, but it's only a small percentage of the actual military. I'm reading report after report of special forces and Afghan commandos complaining about the reliability and utility of the regular army troops that NATO has trained, saying they're not willing to fight. When they do, they do it poorly. They abandon positions. They're just not tactically sound. They create bigger problems. They abandon positions once they're taken at the first sign of the Taliban, baring its teeth. So there's that issue. I'm just not, airstrikes might stop the Taliban from taking a city. Airstrikes might also increase civilian casualties, which will be put on the U.S. back. And airstrikes launched from the Middle East, from the Persian Gulf, or from aircraft carriers are going to be extremely expensive. Very, very expensive. If you were going to do this, you should have kept a base or two in Afghanistan. Basing in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan or Uzbekistan, it's just not going to happen. This is a pipe dream. The Russians are not going to approve the U.S. influence. Remember, the U.S. was kicked out of Kyrgyzstan, what, a decade ago?
Right, right.
Why should we expect that to change? The Russians are going to do what they have to do to keep those borders secure. The last thing they want is more U.S. influence in the region. It supported the Taliban, again, to a far lesser degree than Pakistan and Iran, but did so because it hoped the U.S. would be defeated in Afghanistan as a little bit of payback.
The third part of armed overwatch is special operations, CIA, U.S. military training and equipping Afghan forces, allied militias in Afghanistan. Is the special operations forces under Title 50 of the United States Code, a federal law that allows U.S. military forces to conduct covert operations in support of the CIA. Is that capable of sustaining the Kabul government, knowing there can a strike can come in the night?
That's a lifeline. Again, it might halt the Taliban advance, but I don't think it's going to be enough to retake the territory that needs to be retaken to get the Afghan government back in a position where it can actually rule significant portions of the country. So prior to this, my estimate was the Taliban controlled 73 of those 407 districts. Today we have it at around over 220. I got to run the numbers this morning. So they tripled the amount of territory they controlled, and that happened as soon as the U.S. left. The other thing too is the Taliban are going to start targeting those CIA and special operations forces. The president wants out of Afghanistan. They want to leave. They're saying they're going to end air support, very likely end air support after August 31st when the U.S. wants to be completely out of Afghanistan. And now we're going to expect the U.S. government to put CIA and special forces inside of Afghanistan when the Biden administration wants to disengage. Remember, he does not want any involvement in this war. I think this is a complete misread of the situation. If he didn't want to be in this position, he wouldn't have announced the complete withdrawal. The real solution to all this, John, by the way, would have been a phased withdrawal announced to the Afghans, giving them deadlines and saying, we're leaving by this date. You need to have this accomplished, and this accomplished, and maybe set up something like private military contractors to do the maintenance, maybe even have them fly an Air Force and help train the Afghan forces and could fund that. But done all this on a withdrawal timeline, all of this other stuff is just a way to get the U.S. to re-engage in a war that it wants to, that its president wants to disengage from.
Bill, my thought now, right now, Kandahar's under attack by the Taliban. Do they have the forces yet to hold that city, or is this draining resources from and introducing doubts? We have about 30 seconds. How do you read the strategy of this?
Yeah, the Taliban, so the thing, the situation in the South is so bad that I don't see how the government would be able to reorganize to retake it. They don't need a lot of forces to hold it. They will need a significant number to take it. But they've had this offensive on Kandahar and over a dozen other capitals ongoing for the last month now, and they haven't relented. But look, the Taliban certainly has its concerns. Has it overreached? Is it overextended its lines? We don't know the answer to that, but I suspect they've calculated this and they have the resources to take and hold cities, particularly in the South, where everything surrounding Kandahar, everything surrounding Lashkargah is Taliban controlled.
Bill Rajo, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and his colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is a tale of woe. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.